Happy Monday. It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's podcast, an interview with Dale and Brendan. These days, Dale is a drummer at the Stratford Festival's production of The Who's Tommy. Dale's played with everyone from Supertramp's Roger Hodgson to Canadian blues musicians like Morgan Davis and Michael Pickett. But before she shared the stage with these talented musicians, she shared the back of a van with her group of guys going from town to town in Northern Ontario doing cover tunes in bars. She'll tell us how she made the transition from the bars to North America's largest repertory theater company, the Stratford Festival. That's coming up a little bit later on The Inadequate Life. Thanks for listening, by the way. I really appreciate your company here tonight or this morning, wherever you might be listening. I got a cup of tea going. This is called Yoshadora Darjeeling. And of course, the tea's from Tea Leaves in Stratford. I'm happy to say that Tea Leaves is a very fine and the very first sponsor of The Inadequate Life. Thanks to Karen for going out on a limb and agreeing to help me out with the show. And I'm telling you, she has the best tea anywhere. And just talking about the Who's Tommy, when Pete Townsend was in Stratford to check out the production of Tommy, he dropped in at Tea Leaves. I'm not kidding. Honest to God's truth. He picked up some of Karen's special tea blends, Canadian Breakfast. That's a special blend she put together. And Stratford Earl Grey. It's like an Earl Grey with sort of a twist. Karen's a certified tea sommelier. So if you like tea as much as I do, go online, visit stratfordtealeaves.com, or just visit the shop in Stratford next time you're there and tell her Keith sent you. I was just in Stratford, by the way. I saw Tommy, and it is quite a spectacle. I highly recommend going to see it. I was there by myself. Susie couldn't make it that night. And it's odd when you're sitting, you know, by yourself in a theater and you never know the vibe from the people next to you. And there was a family next to me, and sort of right beside me, there was this teenage boy. And we're all kind of just waiting for the house lights to dim, you know, with that eager anticipation. And all of a sudden, boom, there's this like really loud and powerful pounding of the drums. And that sort of started the overture and basically started the show. And everyone around us, we were just sitting near the front, actually, everyone around us was completely caught off guard. And I'd say they were even frightened by the sound. You saw some people jumping and stuff. It was really, really cool. And the guy on my left, this teenager, gives me this look with that big sort of rock and roll smile. Rock and roll, let the show begin. It was very, very cool. And of course, it is quite a rock and roll show. And I'm thinking, those were Dale's drums. How cool is that? I got to interview her. And you're going to get to hear that interview too. Before we do that, one more thing. I'd love some feedback from you guys. This is my first podcast after all. So visit theinadequatelife.com and click there's a tab there. It says say hello. If you've got a microphone hooked up to your computer, you know, for like calling Skype, whatever else you might do with a microphone on your computer, you can leave me a message right from the page there, the say hello page, and it just records your file and I'll play it on the show if you say something nice. Or you can just email me right from the page and I'll read some emails next time. So please do that. Just go to theinadequatelife.com and click say hello. If there's someone from southwestern Ontario or Toronto, an actor, performer, writer you'd like to hear on the show, let me know and I'll do my best to get them on the show. All right, it's time for my chat with Dale and Brendan. So here we are in at a studio, and this is where you teach?
This is my teaching studio, one day a week, 5 kids. Bang, 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 bang.
Wow. So 5 hours nonstop with the
No,
kids.
No. 5 half hours.
Oh, yeah. That's not so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did you take drum lessons when you were a kid?
Absolutely.
Who did you take them from?
Professor Robert Hughes at the University of Western Ontario from grade 9 until grade 13, and then went to Western and started studying again with Professor Robert Hughes. And the principal timpanist with Orchestra London, Darcy Gray.
Okay.
And those were my two main teachers. And in the middle of my degree at Western, I took 1 year off and I went to Humber College.
Sure. Yeah.
Studied some jazz drumming there with Roger Flock. Came back, finished my degree under pain of death. And
what do you mean, painted like some parental pain of death?
No, actually, Roger Flock said, "You're not coming back to Humber. You're going back to Western to finish your degree."
Good for him.
Yeah, I know. And
wow.
It was, obviously an important thing to do to complete a degree rather than leave it hanging after a few years.
Wow. Why did you feel like you didn't want to finish it? Do you remember?
I just wanted to play the drums.
Of course.
And I was studying classical percussion at Western. And, you know, all I wanted to do was play. And the studying academic thing was grinding me into a nub.
So when you say play, do you mean you wanted to play like more rock, less timpani and less symphonic? Is that what was going on?
No, I wanted to just play. I just didn't want to be indoors studying when I could be playing the drums or playing timpani or playing crash cymbals or playing triangle or
what kind
whatever.
Of stuff do you study in third year? I guess with fourth year at Western at that point, you were going back to do? Or
I lost count.
Yeah,
it took a long time to grind.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It took me a long time. It's a miracle I got out. Actually,
yeah.
But so when you went back to Western, there was that much theory in the program that you weren't actually...
Oh, lots. Yeah, huh. The music program is very intense, very busy, very academic. It was then. That was quite some time ago.
Yeah.
And so a lot of music history, a lot of theory, and all the spin-off topics from that.
Yeah, I teach journalism at Western, and it's a one-year MA part of the program that I teach in, and we find that as well, that after the students have done... their internship. So now we send them out. They might be at Global. They might be at BBC in the UK. We've had students go to China. Then they come back for the last portion of their studies and they're like, no, we're ready to work. We don't want theory. We just want to get out and do it. So that's exactly where you were.
Yeah. And people always said, you know, you need to go back and get your degree because, you know, it'll look good on your resume. But you
for the drumming jobs.
I know. No one ever asked me for a resume. But, you know, you do need. It's just nice to have it completed.
Yeah, and once you have it, like when I finished my MA, it took me a long time. And once you finish it, it's yours and no one can ever take it
away
from you. It's a pretty cool thing to have done. Wow. Yeah. So you got out and then what did you do?
Well, it was sort of a gradual progression from when I started my very first year at Western. We also started, a bunch of us, playing with Orchestra London.
Sure.
So I was playing extra percussion with them, and it was sort of a part-time job, and then after I graduated, I'm not really sure what I did, but I was always playing with Orchestra London for years and years and years, and sometimes part-time, and sometimes it got busier, but it was always there, so I always accepted the work, and that was sort of the basis of my career. Yeah. And then I would do spin-off things, which started out being jazz drumming, which, you know, didn't turn into very much, but rock drumming.
Sure.
Freelance drumming, theater drumming.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. But is it good going back to coming out of university and then having Orchestra London to help you practice and also earn a living? You know, when we talk about orchestras and community theater, that's something people take for granted. If we took Orchestra London away, which people are talking about happening, you might not have even stayed in London, and then you might not be teaching kids here today.
I mean, good point.
And I've got a kid, so I think about that a lot. I think, you know, people are talking about, well, we can't afford an orchestra. Well, we lose the orchestra, a whole ton of professional musicians and everything they offer to the society here that we take for granted because you don't see it. You don't see those kids getting the lessons, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true, and a lot of people just say, oh, orchestra, oh, elitism or whatever. But you're right. There's all kinds of spin-off in the community, and having a good teacher who's professional and will show up and teach your kid and is educated. There's a lot of drum teachers out there, but the ones who are professional and responsible, there's quite a few of them, but, you know, it's a pyramid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you've got something like an orchestra where they can anchor themselves.
Exactly.
And I'm sure everyone involved in the orchestra gives back into the community some way or another and touches people's lives beyond, as you said, the perceived elite orchestra, which is such an old school sort of concept. Mm-hmm. So when you were a kid then, when you were younger, do you remember... like, I remember that from my first exposure to the drums when I was a kid, that I really remember was when my dad took me to see Buddy Rich in Montreal. I lived in Montreal.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't know when you're a teenager, oh, this is like a legendary guy, but then you kind of figure out, oh, this is pretty cool. So I remember seeing Buddy Rich when I was a kid, but I don't remember being, oh, and I remember when I saw, for some reason, oh, I do remember Billy Joel's drummer, Liberty Silver. I don't know if
Liberty DeVito.
Yes, okay, yeah. I remember him for some reason, God knows why. I saw Billy Joel in concert, and I was like, wow, that's a cool drummer.
Yep.
And the other drummer, well, there's a couple. The other drummer was April Wine, Jerry Mercer.
Oh, fantastic.
I remember him doing some things, and you're just going, is that him or is that a machine? Like, you know, this is way back when.
Yeah, the London Gardens, didn't
he? Is that where he did it here?
Yeah. That's Jerry where I Mercer. Saw him. Yeah.
And then I was just thinking, I saw Santana a million times too, and he had two guys. He had the guy up front, the older guy, who played, you know, bongo percussion.
Yeah,
I remember that guy too.
And Graham Lehrer, who's from London.
Oh, was he playing with Santana?
Yeah, that was his gig for a long, long time. But he's from London, and he in the early days, like when Santana was huge back in the 70s.
That's what I'm talking.
It was Graham Lehrer, and
so
he's a
cool
Londoner. So that's kind of a cool connection.
It is. And then, so what were you listening to back then? Like, do you remember in the house, what were people listening
to? Yeah, I just remember sort of, like you talk about turning points, the turning point for me was Kiss.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, beauty. But honestly, we were crazy about Kiss and the makeup and the costumes.
How old
were
you at that point?
Like grade eight, maybe.
Sure, yeah.
And into high school. And I don't, you know, their music is what it is. But it was just, that it's sort of, I don't know, I just started thinking about, wow, I think I can play the drums. And then I asked my...
So you hadn't even played until grade eight?
No.
So you get all these people now getting their kids in to play the drums super, super young. So you were in grade eight, high school. Had you done any music before then?
Well, not really. There was music around. And my parents, of course, tried to get me to do piano lessons. But I have four older brothers. So they had all tried piano and quit. And by the time I came along and tried piano and quit, they were like, yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah.
So,
and then Kiss came along.
And then Kiss came along, and I started bugging my dad for drum lessons. And,
that's fascinating.
He gave me a drum, you know, practice pad and some drumsticks, and then wanted to make sure I was going to stick with it, and I did. And then the drum lessons, and at that same time, I was in high school with the music program and followed that along. And I was, you know, I really liked the drums, so I played them all along. And in grade maybe 11 or 12... my friends were in the youth orchestra, so once again, that's a good tie-in with people in the community, and the orchestra, the importance of orchestras. But I just sort of asked the conductor, can I join the youth orchestra? And he said, yeah, we need a percussionist.
So
I did, and I mean, I guess my whole life I've been developing the classical percussion side and the rock drummer thing, it's worked well for me.
And are there any of the drummers, not necessarily the ones we talked about, but popular rock drummers who have that duality? That, you know, that's, is that uncommon?
Yeah, one of the biggest drummers, and everyone's heard him a million times on every hit album, is Kenny Aronoff.
Okay,
who's originally John Cougar's drummer.
Wow!
But he does probably 10 sessions a day, even nowadays. That's he plays with can't even say.
Yeah,
he plays with everybody. And he got his degree originally from a fancy school in the U.S.
Hmm.
And he played all that percussion stuff. But he's known nowadays as a heavy hitter rock drummer.
Actually, that brings to mind that I'm a big Wilco fan, and their drummer, Glenn Kottke, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. I think he studied at Columbia. Do they have a music program? I should know that. But he's a pretty amazing, the things he gets out of his kit when you hear him in concert, and I've heard him a lot, or you even the CDs, you go, okay, there's something more there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's
right.
Part of the education.
Yeah. One of my favorite drummers is Travis Barker. He's the guy from Blink 182
with all
the tattoos.
Oh, my gosh.
And crazy-looking dude. But he is very intelligent musically, and I keep hammering this into people. He's very creative and schooled. But I think his background was probably in American, not military, but Corps.
The Marine Corps type.
Yeah, you know, the parade stuff that they have going on
so
in the U.S.
You can
not
hear
so much
that
here, but
in his drums. You can hear that in his.
Yeah, and if you go and look him up on YouTube, he's got all these things where he's just playing a snare drum, and he just kills it.
Yeah. I met that he came when I was producing the Mike Bullard Show. They came through and very, very early, and it was just three of them, right? They were
punks,
like the greatest guys. Yeah,
punks with attitude, but he's very intelligent.
Yeah. Well, they were really nice guys. I mean, we had every night of the week we had in musicians in different points in their careers. And you mentioned John Mellencamp. We hung out with him and did a little bit of a tour with him. But I do remember Blink 182. They were the nicest young guys you could imagine.
I'm surprised. Well, you know, I mean, you just look at them and you think punks with attitude, which is what they want to convey, I'm sure.
But as you said, he was probably educated and, you know, had the discipline to reach that particular level.
Yeah.
And what were your folks listening to? What kind of music did they listen to in the house?
My strongest memory, I think, is Saturday mornings when the high school kids want to sleep in. Saturday morning was when
that's
my dad...
That's the only time the parents could listen to something.
My dad would put on Beethoven 6 and crank it.
Really?
Yeah. So I always remember Beethoven 6 as like Saturday morning, get out of bed music.
I love that.
My parents liked classical music and light classic, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But one of the inspirations for me, I think, to become a musician was they would have musical parties. And I don't know if people do that. Maybe jam sessions nowadays, sure. but they'd invite over a bunch of their friends. Some of them sang. Someone would just tap on a tambourine. My dad played accordion. Some of his friends played guitar and piano and, trumpet.
Sure.
And they just kind of, I guess they'd be like jamming out folk songs.
That's beautiful. That's classic.
Yeah. yeah. And I just remember like that was, there was a lot of passion that went into what they did and it was inspiring.
Do you remember the first time they invited you into that inner sanctum, or did that ever really happen? Or was your sort of introduction to music too late?
I came back to it many years later. Because, yeah, by the time I was playing the drums, those parties of theirs had faded
right.
away a little yeah. bit. And
okay, so...
we digress.
No, and what did your parents do? What did they
my
do?
Dad was a university professor, and my mom was a teacher librarian in the public school
system.
So
education is super important.
I guess, yeah.
I guess. So were you a good student? So you weren't. It sounds like you weren't a great student then.
No.
How did they like that?
I got by. I mean, you know, by the time I was really failing, like grade 13 and into Western, that's they funny. Sort of were more hands off.
Yeah.
You know, I started out maybe in grade 9 as an A and B student, and yeah. then things just went on a steady.
And then you get busy.
Decline. Well, as I say, my priorities were elsewhere.
For sure. And so you're playing in a band, like cover tunes as a teenager, sort of thing?
Not so much as a teenager. Oddly enough, as a teenager, I never got into a rock band, like, because I'm a woman drummer, and like, it wasn't something my friends were doing. So I was really playing
with
in the
orchestra.
High school band
okay,
and
yeah.
in the youth orchestra. And really it wasn't until after I went to Humber, graduated from Western, that I started becoming like a drummer that would play jazz and play rock.
Yeah. Huh.
So that sort of, I knew how to play it, but I just didn't play it.
So at Stratford, you're obviously doing musicals, and you've been there for a long time, started as a sub, and then mm-hmm. the last couple of years, like, what's the term? What do you call it? Like a member of a company, or what's the actual word to define your...
With Stratford, I'm just on a year-to-year thing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Pretty much everyone is.
So I've been fortunate to get some contracts in the last 4 years with Evita, Jesus Christ Superstar, last year with Charlie Brown, and then this year with Tommy.
Oh yeah. So, what's the? How do they define your position? Is there a rank of percussionist, or so is it?
No, it's just I was really lucky and I got the contract.
That's cool.
And I'm so happy to be there.
And is it a percussionist or drummer? What's the official title, or is it the same?
I don't know. Drums.
Yeah. And percussion. Is there only one? How big is the band? Like, because we never really see them.
Yeah, with Tommy this year, the band is it's 8 or 9. Three keyboards. You do the math. Two guitars, keyboards. A bass. Drums and French horn.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
One
and we're all hidden from the audience. Basically,
sure.
I'm playing me and the bass player are playing down
together.
The hall in a separate room, and the rest of the people are in the pit, but the pit is kind of sealed off.
Yeah, because you can't. It's at the Avon, right?
Yes.
So you can't. You can sometimes see the pit, but I guess for this show, it's
for this
up.
Show. Yeah, it's you can still kind of if you get your head right up there.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Well, I do when I took Cole to see Peter Pan, I'm pretty sure we looked over and saw the musicians there. I think that was
possible. That was
so you're not even with. So the rhythm section is on its own. You must have some sort of monitor so you can see what's
yes.
going on.
Yeah. So I'm lucky. I have a monitor of the conductor, obviously, and then one of the stage, so I can see what's going on stage. But the poor bass player just has the conductor. He has no idea what's going on stage, and. This year for Tommy, it's amazing. I'm not trying to put a plug because it's going to sell out no matter what.
Sure.
It's amazing.
It
the
is,
stuff
eh?
They're doing is, yeah.
That's so good. And you're Keith Moon, basically.
Yeah. And it's like a rock show. The you know, it's a musical, but it's done like a Madonna or something.
And how grueling physically is that for you to do that like every night? You'd never do two shows in one day, right?
No, it's about 4 shows a week.
Okay.
And which is great. And,
you sweat like you're sweating by the end of it?
Well, they're just working on air conditioning for my drum room.
Oh, my gosh. No, they didn't think of that
when they
put you down the hallway.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine. The rehearsal period has been intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. But once we get into four shows a week, it's like...
It's not like a rock show. You get... There are down periods. It's not wall-to-wall music like Jesus Christ Superstar, is it?
It's 2 hours, like, you know, is, 8 till 10, and intense. There's very little time to...
So you'd be sweating.
Well...
Okay. Not like some
I
of the...
I perspire.
That's hard work. And then the air conditioning, that, so they'll have to make that soundproof, too. Listen, I'm thinking like a producer now. Like, uh-oh, yeah. You got to get air conditioning, but it's got to be quiet.
Well, it was soundproof, but they stopped up all the ducts or something. Yeah, so yeah. There's no air in there.
You're
but anyways,
in those kind of crazy situations.
Yeah.
When did you, would you say you're into musicals? Was there ever a period in your life when you actually absorbed that music just for fun? Or was that never your thing?
What are you getting at? the thing about being a musician, at least for me, is that whatever I'm playing is whatever I love. So if I'm playing symphonic music, I love it. Yeah. There's very little that I don't love. If I'm playing opera, I love opera. If I'm playing rock, I mean, you know, most of the time, if you're playing with good people and good tunes, I'll play country, you know.
Yeah.
And so musical theater happened to come along, and it's all great stuff.
Oh, for sure.
And
yeah.
And so much more so when you're playing it.
Yeah, the first time I saw West Side Story live, which was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, that was it. I'm like, this is the most amazing concert in a long time that I've been to. Oh, look, there's people on stage dancing. But the music was so beautiful.
Yeah.
It was just an amazing production. So, Tommy, I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Can't miss it.
Yeah, and how was Jesus Christ Superstar for you? Was that because that was like a seminal album? Was that something you remember from your youth? And all
absolutely,
of a sudden,
yeah. my family, we were just all over that album. We must have worn out 5 copies of it. And, you know, my brother kept saying, you know, oh, I know that's different there, that little, you know, 16th note, or that person's voice didn't quite do that there, or whatever, you know, like, I mean, we knew that album. So then to get a chance to play it over and over and over again, because we did a whole run at Stratford,
yeah.
And then we took the show down to San Diego.
Oh, so you
and
got
played,
to go to San Diego.
Yeah, 8 shows a week for 6 weeks there. So
oh my
it was
gosh.
Awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, and like great tunes the whole.
Sure.
You know, the whole show from start to finish is great.
Just
tunes.
A fun night.
And great, you know, that happened to be a fantastic cast. You said you're interviewing Shalina tomorrow.
Of course.
Just a fantastic cast, full of great talent and fun people. And
I don't want to pry, but then why not Broadway? So if you went from here to La Jolla, and then was there an opportunity to go to Broadway, or is there issues with musicians unions and all that sort
exactly.
of stuff?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. For a Canadian musician to actually work on Broadway is difficult.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So you can do off, so La Jolla's okay. That's easy.
That was a struggle, too. There's the unions are protective for their own
sure.
people, and I totally understand that.
Of course.
And yeah. I was thinking, you know, gee, like if I went to Manhattan, it would be great, but there's people struggling to live in Manhattan, and I'm coming down just
right.
to sort of go for a ride.
Yeah.
It was fine that it worked out that way.
Still, it's got to be hard to have something you built. I mean, you were part of building the
sure.
show, and
yeah.
then all of a sudden, you just got to wave goodbye. Okay, have
well,
fun, everybody.
I know. An aspect of it was tough, but another aspect was that I was staying home and doing what I do here,
yeah,
so
yeah.
I didn't lose any connections that way
yeah,
either. So.
Yeah, and you're back at Stratford this season.
Exactly.
Yeah, and did you ever have a desire to go see it with someone else playing the drums, or would that...
I did. I went down to New York to see it. Because I had never actually seen the show from the audience. Yeah. So, yeah, definitely.
And were you really, like, zoning in on the drums and going, Or was it... That's kind of be weird. It was okay.
I mean, he played pretty much what I played, and, you know, and it's... Because it's a written-out book.
Sure.
You're never actually doing your own thing.
Yeah.
You're always under guidelines.
Yeah. And then, so this year it's Tommy, and something else is here, or just Tommy?
The other musical there is,
right.
Fiddler on the Roof.
Right.
And that's with another gentleman on percussion.
So you sub for... How long were you sort of subbing for?
A long time.
A long time. And I guess that's sort of the route that people take. You come and you go. And then did someone just... leave to sort of open the place for you there? How did that work out?
Yeah, there was a change of musical director,
yeah.
and
okay.
One of the percussionists retired, so yeah. things did open up.
And you have to yeah. formally audition?
No, with...
Because they know you, because you've been there for so long.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you were talking about West Side Story, and really that was kind of an audition for me, because it was with the new music director, Rick Fox, and I subbed in for that.
Okay.
It's a hard musical.
And you were just no problem.
So I did get a contract the year after, so I guess that was good.
Yeah. So they asked you to do West Side Story. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But if you're subbing on a show like West Side Story, are you paid to train and learn the score and you just kind of, when the phone rings, you show up? How does that work? Is it actually you're in a rotation once every now and then you come in to keep you up?
No. There's a gentleman that I've been subbing for many years, and so he needs me for, let's say he's going to Germany from September 1st to September 20th.
Yeah.
So he needs me to fill in for that time.
Yeah.
Then I set about learning the show. And the interesting part about subbing in for a show is the whole orchestra, give or take a few people, has been playing it since February. So they've done 100 performances. And then you come in as a sub and you have to make it sound like you've just done 100 performances. So the preparation for subbing for a show is immense and intense.
So are you sitting in a room by yourself, just going over the score? Is that how do you actually do it? How do you learn?
A number of ways, and I set up at home as though I'm at the theater. So if there's a timpani here and a wood block there, I duplicate the setup at home. I manage to get a what the conductor is doing, videotape of the conductor, copy of the music, like audio tape and obviously the written out music, and just try and make it so that I'm already there. So that when I am there, it's like, like an Olympian would practice, like when you talk about Michael Phelps,
he's
already
done it. But
those
are all solo sports, because music is a group thing, right? Because at the end of the day, it's part of a team. It's like if you're trying to learn how to play basketball by yourself without being able to pass the ball around on some level, no?
Not so much.
No,
because
your part.
You know, yeah, and you just try and mimic so much of what the person before you has done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And how long would it take to learn a 2-hour show like West Side Story?
You want to do the very, very best you can. And you want the cast to be able to do their job seamlessly. And you don't want them in the mid-flip to say, what? I've never heard that there before. Or for them in the middle of a line to say, you know, who just dropped something on the timpani or what?
Does that happen?
No, not with me.
Okay.
You just.
That's great. I love it. I've never heard that in the show, but I guess it happens. Eh?
Well, you know,
over
the course of how many performances.
For sure.
Yeah. So you just want everything to be as seamless as possible. You don't want your orchestra colleagues to turn around and go,
yeah,
that's way too loud. That's way louder, you know, or whatever. You
so,
just
like, literally, how long sitting by yourself in a room with a videotape of the conductor and the score on the before you got to go and do it? That'd be nerve wracking.
It's very nerve wracking. I know it's into the hundreds of hours.
Yeah,
because yeah.
And then, so the other thing that's interesting. So there's that, and then there's the work you did with Jeans and Classics.
Yes.
And you've traveled around. Is that right, Jeans and Classics?
Yeah.
Talk a bit about that. I've never been to a show. I've heard about the shows, but I've never been to one. So it's orchestral arrangements of classic rock?
Yes and no. It's more like a rock band with an orchestra accompaniment.
Okay.
So you have a vocalist and you have the guitar and the keyboards and the rhythm section, bass and drums. And then you have the orchestra as well. So it's like, Elton John has done that,
sure,
and the Moody Blues
Moody
did
Blues,
that a long time
yeah.
ago, and all kinds of people have done it since, Peter Gabriel, and the list goes on and on. So we're trying to recreate that, and, you know, some of the really fabulous shows are like Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon,
of
the whole album with orchestra, and that's so fun. It's so fun to play that stuff. That's a little bit more, you're dancing between trying to play sort of quiet enough so that the symphony orchestra doesn't toss you out and trying to get that rock edge as well.
So you're the rock person in that scenario, or you're the symphony person?
Well, I've done both, but as the rock drummer,
yeah,
you're there to play rock, and the rock band plays rock, and the orchestra plays the charts. And
and is that what I saw Roger Hodgson from Supertramp? So he was part of that process. You did that with him as well. How was that?
I was playing percussion for that, so a little bit more in the background.
And for Supertramp, has that in there. I think of them as being very orchestral anyway.
Yeah. But anyways, what a treat. Like, once again, I go back to this music of my youth, and then I get to be on stage with the guy. It's fabulous.
Yeah. When I was at open mic, Roger Hodgson was coming through Toronto and he decided to come on the show. And it was early in the sense of him sort of coming out, because he was sort of sheltered away for a while after Supertramp broke up. And he was very quiet.
Yeah.
So he was in town to receive an award. And he decided, Roger Hodgson, to come on the show. So part of my job was making that happen and making sure everything's okay. So he comes on. early to rehearse because the bands would always come in to rehearse. But it was just him. He shows up with his guitar. And there's our band, the show band, the four guys that are there every night. And Roger's like, okay, you know what? I'm going to waive all the publishing rights. Well, let's do all my own songs that I own the rights to for bumpers for the show. So going in and coming out. So, you know, we can do, School from Crime of the Century, yeah, or The Logical Song or Breakfast in America. And we can just do whatever we want, guys. And the band all kind of like just sort of scratching because they were all these young guys. They didn't know the tunes at all, right? Oh. And it's not like we have, you know, hundreds of hours to rehearse. It's like 4 o'clock. We're going live at 8.
Yeah, oh my.
And then the piano player, Tony, was the older guy in the band. And he kind of gets it and he goes, all right, no problem. And then Roger kind of figured out what was going on and they all just had a good laugh. And then they all worked, but that's
Isn't
it. You know, as you said, Roger, he was just the nicest.
Oh, yeah, really nice guy.
Really nicest guy. And he said, mm-hmm, okay, we'll just make it work. Here are the notes here. I don't speak that language, but here's how it happens. And
oh, it's funny. Time marches on.
Yeah, and you got to do the show. Like, it's okay. We got to figure it out. We got 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's make it work. But I'll never forget him showing up with his guitar. And it was really, really one of those moments. The other one on the show, which is not a drummer, but I was really proud of getting Kim Wilson. You know, Kim Wilson, the harmonica player.
Oh, yeah.
From, everyone knows him from the Time with the Thunderbirds.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, he was part of that whole scene. And you've played with some blues drummers. I know Jack DeKaiser and Morgan Davis.
Yeah.
So Morgan Davis, he's one of my favorite Canadian blues artists from way back, 89, the album.
Crazy,
I think it was called.
Talented dude.
I love him. I think it was called Morgan Davis. I worked at CBC. I used to play cuts off that as much as I could.
Mm-hmm. And, he's so funny.
And I've never seen him live. Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
Never seen him.
Very interesting person, as you can imagine.
Well, his writing is interesting, too.
Yeah.
Like, he's a good writer as well.
Yeah.
And
Jack
DeKaiser and Michael Pickett, who was nominated for a Juno Award.
Yeah. So Morgan Davis used to have a cigarette lighter, like from a car, in his guitar amp. So he'd plug in the cigarette lighter in his guitar amp and then light a smoke. That was when you could smoke in bars.
Back in the day. Yeah, that's true. And so you're playing with the blues guys. That's a whole different world than being the timpani drummer in the youth orchestra. Like, how did that feel?
Well, I guess one point that I could make is that I've been able to make a living just by doing things locally. It's really hard to just move to a new town and say, I'm a drummer. And, you know, it works eventually. But in London, I've born and raised, so I have all these connections.
Yeah.
So obviously the person I was studying with got me into Orchestra London. That was, a seamless transition.
Sure.
In London, a while ago, there was just so many blues clubs.
Hmm.
And so, you know, you start off playing blues locally with your friends, but then all these people come through, like Morgan Davis and so on. But then I guess I also went to Toronto and started jamming at some blues clubs and actually met those guys and got on their lists.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be an example of actually, you know, going to a different city and making new connections. But generally, if you just keep expanding what you do in your local area, that seems to be the most successful thing.
And never decided to join up with a rock band and tour, or join up with a blues band and tour?
Oh, done all that.
Oh, you have done that? Oh, we didn't even talk about that. What was your first tour?
Back in the day when everyone was going up in Northern Ontario.
In a van?
In a van. But in those days, you could do 6 nights a week.
That's insane. Because there were so many clubs.
No, 6 nights a week at the same club.
Oh, 6 nights
a week
at the same club.
If you, Kappa's Casing and Timmins and Horn Pain and Elliott Lake and all those communities, you'd play Monday to Saturday. And then Saturday night.
That's not bad. So you hang around a bit, get to know the town.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I'm putting a nice spin on it, right? You're sleeping on top of the bar and it smells like beer.
Oh, you know, whatever. But I got to know Northern Ontario.
I want the whatever bar. So did you ever call your parents going, oh, I've made the wrong choice. What am I doing? I'm freezing. I'm with a bunch of guys. The van smells like urine. What's going on?
The very first week, we went up to Kirkland Lake, and my husband's waving bye-bye, like,
oh,
I don't
no.
know what's this going to lead
oh,
to.
My God.
And so I call him, and in those days, no cell phones, right? So payphone, and the payphone's beside the men's can. So it's 1 o'clock in the morning, the band finishes, and I'm calling my husband, hi, honey. And just then a guy walks by and says, hey, want to come into the men's can and do a line?
Oh, no.
Really, honey, I'm fine. I'm not going to take him up on that.
Oh, no.
So...
That must have been a relationship tester. I mean, and that's part of living this life in the arts is you're away. I mean, if you're touring as an actor, as a musician, your home life is, it's just a whole different thing.
Yeah. And my husband's a musician, so he understands what it is to need to go on the road to do a project to better yourself.
For sure, and just build your chops and all that.
Yeah.
How long did you do that for then in that period? And was this, what were you playing? Was it rock?
Classic rock. Yeah. You know, Heart, Journey.
Oh, covers.
Covers, yeah. Just Van Halen, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we all had big hair and spandex pants. And
well, that was the period when the guys and the girls, you probably couldn't tell them apart.
Yeah.
that fuzzy hair.
The platinum blonde thing.
Jeez.
Yeah.
And how? What made you stop doing? So was there ever a moment where you thought you were the band that could actually, we were on the verge of making it? Or?
No, not with, that was just a cover band.
Yeah.
It was just a cover band, and you know, there's projects you think, oh, this might go somewhere.
Were you ever a Ringo in a band? Not Ringo, the other guy, the Pete Best. Would you ever leave a band and they made it, and you're like, oh, geez.
No.
Well, so you made the right choice.
I mean, the band that I really thought was going to make it, that had a lot of potential, was Popjoy. And they became the Joys.
Okay, yeah.
And then Sarah Smith, and now she's out on her own. And she's immensely talented. And we really had a good thing going with Popjoy. And I just thought, the recipe for success is so convoluted. It's so hard to figure out what other piece of the puzzle you need to snap in there to make it over the top. Yeah. And we just couldn't quite do it. And so I quit.
Yeah,
I bailed.
And did you have, when you bailed, did you have something? So was there ever a period in your life as an artist and a musician that you thought, I need to get a civilian type job now? I need to do something to cover the, or, you know, were you always okay?
No, there were times where I had to get a straight job for sure. But it wasn't ever like, I'm going to have to give up music. It was like, things are pretty, you know, tight right now.
Yeah, I hear that. And one of the folks I interviewed for the podcast was saying that you can't have that. He said as a young person, he realized that as long as he had a backup plan, the creative path he was on was never going to come to its fruition because he'd always had this backup plan. So he abandoned a backup plan. He said, I'm not going to have a parachute. I'm not going to have I'm doing this acting thing or die. Yeah. That was his thing.
Well, I think so, because the times where I've tried to do something on the side, it has become way too large of a distraction, and I don't like it, so I ditch it. And then, you know, 2 years later, I find myself with, and it's not a backup plan, because I'm always busy enough, but I have other interests, so I try and do other interests, and it's overwhelming. And the best example of that would be I had the Sweet Music Center from 2006 to 2011, and it was a place on Burwell Street in York, and it was a teaching center.
Okay.
And so I taught there, and then I thought, well, other people can teach there, and we'll all, you know, help pay the mortgage.
Build a center.
Build a center. And I thought, because I just thought it would be something that would be more autonomous.
Sure.
But it turned into, like, every small business, you have to be there.
All the time.
All the time. Yeah. Like, all the time. And it was just overwhelming, and then I could feel like things slipping away.
And now you're all of a sudden the boss.
And the boss, and you know, everything that goes along with that. And so it was 5 years of absolutely being overwhelmed with no time to do anything.
No, so you couldn't really play, you were managing
and
teaching.
Well, I still was trying to fit in all the playing that came my way. So, you know, it was a huge conflict, and the ultimate answer was to get rid of the teaching center, unfortunately, because I didn't want to do that, but there was no other solution. Hmm.
So five, how many years did you do that?
5 years, almost to the day.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And how hard is it to make that decision that you just said, okay, we're shutting down, we're done?
Oh, it was came along for years. I just thought, I've got to get out of this, got to get out of this. And it actually took a couple of years to extricate myself from that.
And then what did you land on when it was done? Now, did you have something, a backup plan after that? Because all of a sudden things changed now, and you got more free time, so back.
No, I mean, that was 2011, so I was doing Jesus Christ Superstar.
So it was just that recently.
I had lots of work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I just sort of closed the door and walked away and went, hey, freedom.
Yeah.
Got time to, you know, ride my bike or whatever.
And play. And then you moved, have you been in Stratford for a long time?
Mm-hmm, since 1990.
Okay. Yeah. And why did you leave London to go there? What was the connection there?
Oh, well, a roundabout way. I mean, hooked up with my husband, and then we went to lived in Toronto for a few years, and would live in Stratford for 6 months and Toronto for six months because I was trying to make a career as a jazz drummer in Toronto. And then it was just too difficult. So once again, we decided to make just Stratford our home.
Yeah.
And once again, then you get integrated with people and the work pops up.
It's a great story.
Thanks.
Like, no, it really is, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like the concentric circles diminishing, you know, from Toronto to the operation in London. You get rid of that and focusing on, at least for a couple of months of the year anyway, Stratford, keeping you super busy.
Yeah. And I mean just in terms of the focus of your podcast, it just seems like the marketplace decides, you know, to promote you or to demote you.
Yeah.
If there's work and if you're doing the work well, then you should be always expanding that or handling what you have.
And the lucky thing for you is you haven't had to travel recently. You've been able to stay home most of the time, haven't you? Or?
Well, I like to travel.
Oh, you
I mean,
do? Okay.
You know, we started talking about the jeans and classics and the traveling there. That's really fun.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Peter Brennan likes to travel in limos. So we're like rock stars in a limo, and we'll drive down to Detroit Airport, and then you have sushi at the sushi place in Detroit Airport, and then you fly somewhere. And, you know, we stay in nice hotels, shuttled into the gig. And, you know, sometimes it's you're squishing
hall.
All this into the weekend.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of travel and a lot of, you know, rehearsal and concerts, and it's very intense. But that's more the rock star lifestyle that I'd like to
But
pursue.
Fascinating, though, that it's coming with jeans and classic. Not a rock star kind of not a. It's a whole different world that didn't exist when you were even think about back
true.
Then.
Yeah, true.
Because Peter basically is he's the guy that created that whole concept and just sort of turned it around.
Mm-hmm.
That's so cool.
Yeah,
right
he's
right
got a real
here.
Empire, you know, and he's at the right place at the right time, and he writes beautiful charts for your orchestra, and he's slowly developed.
Yeah.
In concentric circles, from London, Kitchener, you know, Detroit, and out
and
to
around,
North,
around
America.
North America. In Germany, too, did I hear that? Did you, or something else in Germany you did?
I'm not sure about that, but the best gig we did with Jeans and Classics was in Anchorage, Alaska, last February.
Anchorage?
For the weekend, yeah.
Huh. I'm trying to think, is Jewel from Anchorage? No, she's from somewhere up there, Jewel. What was it like in Anchorage? Cold, I'm guessing.
Well, we got there during a warm spell, but it's an amazing place.
Yeah.
I mean, to be able to go to Anchorage for business is wonderful, because I would not necessarily get there on my own. You know.
And did they have a nice hall, nice place to do the show?
Beautiful, yeah. And they bring in a lot of acts there because they're so remote that they do attract a lot of shows.
And as you said, it's probably a really once-in-a-lifetime experience to go up there.
Awesome.
So what's a buddy who plays drums asked me to ask you, what's your ideal kit, your ideal drum kit?
Oh, well, I'm a Yamaha endorser, and I've played on Yamaha Recording Customs pretty much since 1987, I think, and they're the best drums. If I do a blues gig, I bring a little four-piece kit, and for the Tommy setup, it's like a 7 or 8-piece kit with 2 timpani and electronic drums and tambourines and all that. So it gets to be Neil Peart-esque.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet him?
No, but one of my kids is going through all these Rush songs, and one of my students, and he's just like eating it for breakfast. It's amazing. And Neil Peart is a genius.
Yeah.
Like when you look at the transcriptions we have, you think, no way anyone could play that. But Neil Peart does it.
That's pretty. And just being able to read that and recognize, okay, this is...
And my student, Noah, he's reading all this stuff, like 7, 8 passages, and, you know, very complex.
You talked about being out on the road and with a band. Were there a lot of female drummers around? Like, did you have a female drummer that you sort of, that was a role model? Or was that something you even thought about when you were a kid? I'm just going to play drums.
Yeah, there wasn't a role model. And when I was at Humber College, people used to peer in the window when I was practicing and sort of point and like, ooh, girl drummer. You know,
how did that make you feel?
Well, I was like, get over it, for God's sake. You know, that was the 80s, but still.
Yeah.
You know, and even nowadays, it's still a novelty.
It is,
which is
still,
you know, there's a lot of girls playing drums, but a lot of times if I'm playing in a boisterous bar or something and you know, people would be going, right on, a chick on the drums, you know. So that still is enough of a novelty that
that's
it's
interesting,
being
huh?
commented on.
My question is that annoying? But you can't really answer that question because those are fans. And
yeah, no,
you know.
It's I don't find it annoying because, you know, people are excited that
sure.
that I'm doing it.
Yeah,
and,
regardless.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's great, and it's supportive because, you know, there's a dark side to being a female drummer as well, which is sometimes, you know, you don't get the opportunities that you should have.
Did you was there a period where you felt that as a drummer?
Not a period, but from time to time you just get some attitude from someone like, yeah. Really, a girl on the drums? Well, she's not going to be able to cut it or whatever. That
yeah.
It does exist, but the totally bonus side of all of that is that you get more recognition as a female drummer, whether you're even adequate or not. There's still, you know what I know.
Well, but then you still got to, at the end
because,
of the day, you got to have the chops.
You
might open the door.
Yeah. But in other words, I think it might be easier, for instance, for me to, I don't know whether I should say this, but I'm going to get an endorsement because they need females on their roster.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, and that's not to say that it's unwarranted.
Well, hopefully it'll encourage other women. I mean, that's.
But put it this way. It's sometimes harder for guys to pop their heads above the crowd,
right, yeah,
whereas for me,
yeah,
it's easier.
So when you were a kid, it wasn't like you didn't think, oh, Karen Carpenter was a drummer. That wasn't something that was in your yeah. And the other one that I remember seeing was Sheila E. Remember Sheila E.?
Yeah,
the percussionist.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But when I first started, there was not a role model, and Karen Carpenter was like
they took her away from the drums
yeah.
and made her stand up.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
was the thing.
Yeah, yeah. But when I see people like Sheila E. and Cindy Blackman and people like that, I just go, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah,
you know.
Who's yeah. Cindy Blackman?
She was playing with Lenny Kravitz.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've seen Lenny Kravitz. I can't believe I didn't that didn't
well,
register.
Well, he's used a number of drummers,
okay.
but she played with him for a while, and she's also like a great, great jazz drummer who's played
oh,
with
cool.
very famous people, and she does it all. She's really good.
Huh. And you know, it's funny when like I'm not musically inclined. I can't hold a tune. I think I have a good ear. I think I can hear things, but I can't yeah. sing and I can't play. But I always thought I had rhythm
mm-hmm.
until I, because do you remember the Incredible Bongo Band?
No.
there was, when I was a kid, I'll never forget. It was probably introduced to me on one of the K-Tel albums. But there was this, I had the album. It was the K-Tel. I love the single so much about the album. So I always thought I had rhythm and I could play the bongos until I actually really tried. And I'm
yeah.
like, oh my God, I can't even do that.
Oh no.
But I think everyone thinks they can play the drums, right?
Really?
I think so. Like, and then you actually physically get behind a kit and it's like, oh my God, this is crazy. My foot's doing one thing and my hand is doing
yeah.
another thing. Like,
right.
it's
right.
not as easy. It's impossible. Like,
well, I'm, you know, it's all, we have to put the time in. No one.
Sure.
You know, some people gravitate towards it easier, but you put the time in.
Yeah. And are there ever kids that you just kind of go, well, maybe the drums aren't for you when you're doing the teaching?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's got to be hard, though.
Well, you know, it's just.
Or do you let them kind of figure it out?
Yeah. If the kids aren't interested, then they won't practice. And I tell the parents, like, this isn't really working out. And
yeah.
it's all mutual, you know.
Yeah.
If it's, you know, but on the other hand, you get a good student and they're interested and the parents are into it and there's just a good feeling
that's the
going
best.
Around. So
yeah.
that's the place where I've been in for the last few years. I've got great students and they're all into it and I'm into it and, you
that's
know,
so
it's
exciting.
Just, yeah.
It's
so.
Such a drag they can't see you on stage though. So you there you are, you know, playing drums and Tommy and they
mm-hmm.
can't really, even you talking about the air conditioning, it's like, it's such a different sort of thing to think about.
I was really hoping that Des McAnuff was having this vision of a drum kit right above the stage, but no.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and the whole Keith Moon thing is the explosion on the top, on this Smothers Brothers
yes.
show. Like that's
yeah,
whenever
yeah.
I think, that's all I think
that
about.
That deafened everybody. Yeah.
Yeah, that was such an amazing
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Well, this has been so cool. I can't wait to see the show. I'm excited
I hope
about
you enjoy
that.
It. I mean, I'm just watching it on a black and white monitor, but it looks amazing.
Very cool.
Really.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time and doing this. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have awakened some potential budding drummers. Hey, what's the oldest person? Does anyone come to you like at my age in their 50s and go, I want to learn how to play the drums? Does that happen too?
I have a senior citizen who played when he was a boy and
came
wanted
back to it.
Yeah.
It was tough. Well, I just keep going back to physically. It seems like it's so demanding.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's not that bad. But the mind when you're young is like a sponge, and you know.
Yeah, they say if you don't learn those kind of skills at a very young age, they are much harder to pick up later.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so I spent all my time doing card tricks, which is a shame because I could have been probably a decent pianist or something.
Oh, wow.
But now I can shuffle cards really well.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, thanks so much.
Thank you, Keith. Okay. I appreciate that.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, there you go, Dale and Brendan. I hope you had as much fun listening to that as I had talking to her. She's lots of fun. And I recorded that interview before I went and saw Tommy, which I did say at the top of the show. It's definitely worth seeing. Go check it out at Stratford if you can. I want to say a special thanks to James Rainey. He's the arts journalist at the London Free Press. And a few years ago, he wrote a story about Dea, and that's how I kind of tuned into her story. And when I read his story, I thought, wow, she'd be a fun person to talk to. And of course, she was. You probably heard Dale mention that I'm interviewing Shalina Kennedy, the star of Jesus Christ Superstar that was on Broadway, and we talked about her appearance in Evita and West Side Story. Anyway, this summer, Shalina's at the Charlottetown Festival, starring in Ted Dykstra's new musical, Evangeline. And I'll play the conversation I had with Shalina just after the show opens. That's going to be in late June, so come back for that. Before we go, one of the reasons I started this podcast is to remind everybody, and probably mostly myself, is that we all go through ups and downs in pursuit of the creative inspiration. So it's important to remember that no one makes it on their own, and part of the creative process is just taking risks, right? Taking a risk, trying something, being afraid, and then seeing what happens. And of course, inevitably, with that comes failure. So the message to you is do what you can do to surround yourself with good people, and most importantly, do good work yourself. Come back every Monday for another episode of The Inadequate Life. Thanks for listening. I'm Keith Tomasek.